Support for today's show comes from Shutterstock. Every business needs high-quality images to attract and to keep customers. So whether you're making brochures or ads or putting the final touches on your next tweet, the visuals you choose are proven to make a big difference. Get started today with a 20% discount at shutterstock.com/wolfden. Comedian Doug Benson loves movies so much he made a podcast about it. Now you can hear all 8 seasons of Doug Loves Movies on Stitcher Premium. Plus, you'll hear bonus episodes and the Benson Interruption completely ad-free. That's over 1,000 hours of Doug Benson podcasts for just $4.99 a month or $34.99 a year. It's ad-free. That means you wouldn't hear me reading stuff like this. Start listening now with a 1-month free trial of Stitcher Premium. You can go to stitcherpremium.com/Doug and use promo code WOLFDEN at checkout to get your free month. That's stitcherpremium.com/Doug and use the promo code WOLFDEN. Are there any other promo codes? No, I don't think so. Welcome to the WOLFDEN, the podcast about the business and the people of podcasting. I'm Chris Bannon. My co-host, Lex Friedman, is away on his luxury yacht this week. Today, our guest is Samantha Hennig. She is the editorial director for audio at The New York Times. Before I start that interview, I think we should do the segment that Lex and I always do. It's called Shows We're Jealous Of, Shows I'm Jealous Of Today. And my pick this week is The Turnaround. It's the new show from Jesse Thorne and Maximum Fun and the Columbia Journalism Review. I think he describes it as the interview show about interviewers and how they do interviews, essentially. And I find it fascinating. I listened to the Susan Orlean episode and the one with Larry King. And you learn things, for instance, like both of them don't believe in prepping too much before conducting an interview. And that's probably a relief to hosts like me and Lex. We don't actually have to prepare. The experts don't do it. So we're off the hook, Lex, wherever you are. And Samantha, before I formally begin the interview, do you have a podcast you're jealous of?
I have several.
Oh, that's good. Go right ahead.
I mean, I think one is one that I'm jealous of because it's the kind of thing that would be a tough fit at the New York Times. So it's not necessarily something that I could see that it's like I'm jealous because we should have done this.
Right.
It's more like I'm jealous because we probably couldn't ever do this. And that's Homecoming.
Oh,
which
yeah.
I liked so much more than I expected to in season one. I generally, fiction podcasts haven't worked for me, even though I love reading fiction. I think because, well, when I'm reading fiction, I generally like contemporary fiction. Mm-hmm. And fiction podcasts that I've listened to have made too much of a show of being a podcast and trying to sound old-timey radio a lot of the time.
A lot of them talk about podcasting in the show itself,
yeah, exactly.
Right?
It's like if you only read books about authors, which a lot of them are. But yeah, Homecoming seemed like it was doing something really different and fresh, and I wasn't thinking about the fact that I was listening to a podcast.
Right. It had beautiful sound design.
It did,
I think,
yeah.
Very contemporary sound design.
Yeah.
What's the other one that you're jealous of?
Well, I feel like it would be unfair not to cop to my jealousy of S-Town and This American Life. I mean, I think that often when I'm putting together like lists of shows to listen to, I leave them off because they seem so obvious. But
right. The
truth is,
here,
like,
this is a safe space. You can say the obvious.
I mean, in terms of things that I listen to and at the end, I'm like, man, that was so good. Those are up there every time.
Well, so I want to ask you a little bit about that. What about S-Town in particular made you, because I have a long, this could be a whole other show about what I think is inside S-Town.
Yeah.
But you go ahead and tell me.
I mean, I think I felt very safe, like I was in expert hands and being taken on this crazy journey. It did have some novelistic elements too, but also reporting and also interesting ethical questions and a fascinating lead character.
Yeah.
And the sound design there was beautiful. I mean, even the album art was beautiful. There was just so much craft to it.
Now, could the New York Times, we're going to get into your actual job in a second, but I find this fascinating because you're somebody who I think for the rest of us seems to have a lot of power and a huge institution behind you. Could the New York Times do a show like S-Town?
I think we could, more likely than doing a show like Homecoming. Mm-hmm. I mean, S-Town feels like, yes, I think I aspire to someday do a show like S-Town.
Well, that's good. That's great. Well, thank you. Now we'll do the formal part of the interview. Samantha Hennig is the editorial director for audio at The New York Times. She oversees the company's audio strategy and the audio team, and that includes the producers and hosts of shows such as Still Processing. Let me see if I have the full list of New York Times shows here. The Daily, The Book Review, Inside the Times, Popcast, The Run-Up, Still Processing, Dear Sugar, and Modern Love. Is that the whole list?
Yes, yeah, some of those are more active than others.
Right. That's a lot to keep track of. And congratulations. I should start with The Daily because I think that's the show. I mean, the others are very, very good, but that's the show that a lot of people are talking about, because it seemed like such an innovation. No one had really attempted to do in podcasting a sort of daily news show. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came to the decision that that was the next show that you had to do? And I'm also curious about what institutional obstacles you faced in the genesis of that.
Sure. It's actually, when we were first laying out our plan for what do we want to do in year one of this audio team, news was something that it seemed obvious that we needed to go there at some point. We're in a news company, but it also seemed like the hardest. And so we figured, okay, well, we'll get to that one last.
Right.
Once we build up this team and once we've got several conversational shows going and maybe have done a couple narrative limited run shows, then we'll deal with news. And then the truth is what ended up happening was we got a launch sponsor, and that tied us into a launch date. And
wow.
Then suddenly—
Sometimes deadlines are useful, right?
Yes. Yeah, we are a real deadline shop.
So how much time did you have from the sponsorship to launch, from the realization that you were going to have to do this?
I think conversations with the sponsor started in the fall, and initially everyone was saying, you know, these things fall through, don't worry about it. And by the time we really knew it was happening, it was around November, probably late November. And so we basically, going into the holidays, needed to staff up for a daily news show that was launching February 1st.
Holy crap.
Yeah, it was fast. So
you had zero staff for the show at the beginning of the year.
Yeah. Our first hire was Theo Balcom from All Things Considered, and she started at the beginning of January. So she was there for less than a month before we launched. And at that point, it was just her and Michael Barbaro, the host, working on it. And Lisa Tobin, our executive producer, got in there with them and was working very closely with them. And then we pulled Andy Mills, who we had hired from Radiolab to work on big sort of long-term projects and had never done anything in more than like a three-month turnaround. We threw him in there too.
Yeah.
And so that team of four is the group that really defined the Daily sound.
But most of them had never worked on a daily show, so they actually didn't know what they were up against.
Right, which I think is part of the beauty of it and how it came to sound the way it does, is that there were no habits to break.
Did you begin doing, how many weeks of daily production did you do before we heard the first one?
So in those, it was about 4 weeks. And in that time, first it was just saying each day, okay, this is what we would do tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was doing a couple of interviews, but just, you know, one per day. So this might be one of the segments tomorrow. And then it really, I can't remember exactly how many full pilots there were, but not a lot. I mean,
right.
It all happened very quickly.
And did you decide on the format before doing those pilots, or did the format emerge as you were making them?
The format emerged. And I think one of the things that was a real aha moment was adding what we call the headlines at the end of the show. So the idea that you do these two deeper dives. And when we had started talking about it, we were always saying 2 to 4 stories. And we really ended up at more like 1 to 2.
Yeah.
We also thought it was going to be 15 minutes, and it's really more like 20 minutes. So some of that stuff came out in the early days. But then, you know, there's always this tension between wanting to go deep on stories and give a lot of context and analysis, and then also wanting to get people up to speed so that they feel like if this is the one thing I listen to, I'm reasonably ready to face the day.
Well, I'm curious about that purpose. The show publishes very early, right?
Yes.
It's a 6 a.m.?
It's a 6 a.m., and I'm the one hitting publish.
You are.
So I'm up at 5 a.m.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, but so what did you think in your head, and I'm curious about whether this has evolved since you actually have a show to put in front of people. In your head, before you launched, what did you think the purpose of the show was?
We initially didn't think it was meant to be exhaustive, and we stand by that. I mean, we never sought to make a show where the purpose was, this is everything you need to know to start the day, which is more, that is kind of the purpose of the morning briefing that the Times does. And mm-hmm. So we felt like the briefing handles that. You can skim that very easily on your commute if you're in a commute where you can use your eyes in that way.
Right. Drivers, of course.
Cannot.
Yeah.
but so what we wanted to do was have the same sort of conversational DNA as the morning briefing, but really make it as an audio first show. And it was through the piloting that we realized that going a little longer felt right, and that seemed like what served the show and the listeners best.
And Michael Barbaro has been the host, has been a guest many, many times on all kinds of shows over the years. What made you decide that he was the host that you needed for that time of day and for the kind of show that you were building?
I don't think we would have known before the run-up. So what basically happened is Lisa Tobin started in July of last year. So it's been almost a year. And she started during the conventions and on her first day said, we should really launch a politics show. And we had been talking, batting that idea around for
right.
a while, but we didn't have the team in place. And so we were all like, yes, let's do it. And so we went right to Carolyn Ryan, who was the politics editor at the time. And she amazingly said, okay, take your pick of our political correspondents, including people, you know, out on the trail. She said, I'm fully supportive of this. And so we ended up with Michael as the host for the run-up, and that came together also very, very quickly. And it was through that process and getting to see what Michael was like as a host that we came to realize that he would be amazing at this, and that he came to realize it too. I mean, I don't think he ever would have dreamed that this would be his full-time job.
And what do you think, if you were to say what his single greatest strength is as a host, what's the one thing that he brings that you feel like, oh, that's really, this has worked out so well because?
Yeah. Someone recently used the phrase tender gravitas about him, and I really like that. And
yeah.
I think that is, that kind of sums it up. He's very earnest in his style. He's not snarky. Off mic, he has moments of
he's
smart.
A writer,
yeah.
Let's be honest.
but in the interviews, he really gives people his full attention. I mean, as any good host does. Mm-hmm. But then that gravitas is important too. I mean, the fact that he was a reporter at the Times for more than 10 years, that the people who he's talking to at the Times are his colleagues who respect him and he knows this material so well. I think that makes a huge difference compared to if we had brought in a host who was kind
of Ted Baxter,
yeah.
Perhaps somebody who's not going to blend well with the institution.
Exactly, yeah.
Let me ask you this, because I know that some news organizations and magazines that start shows have a difficult time persuading writers to come in and be on the show when some of them will feel that it blows their ability to land a story on the front page or to make news with what they're doing. Others simply want to be paid for what they feel is extra work. How did you navigate all of that in the building of, because it features Times writers every day.
Yeah. We've had incredible support from the institution. So right when the show launched, Dean Baquet, the executive editor, sent a note to, I think, all the department's all the department heads saying, this show has launched. Please have your writers be on it. I mean, the message was coming from all levels that this was important to the Times and that people should get on board. And then I think, honestly, one week in, it stopped even being an issue because every time someone goes on the show and they listen to it, they write to us the next morning. And I mean, we get two responses very frequently. One is, wow, that was better than my story. Thank you. I mean, just people getting to hear the story come to life in that way, I think is really exciting for the reporters. And then the other is that people have said, you know, I've been writing front page stories for the Times for a decade, and being on the Daily, I'm hearing from my middle school friends saying, oh my God, I can't believe you were on the Daily. Like, people who have never reached out before about their writing for the Times, because it really does feel so much more intimate and people are connecting with it in a different way. And so once the reporters experience that, they want to come back, even if they're on deadline.
So you've justified why do podcasting, which I'm sure was a question that a lot of people I know asked for years inside the organization. You've managed to extend the brand and put Times content in front of people who might otherwise skip the front page of the paper.
Skip it or do both. I mean, I think a lot of people, just based on the emails we get and the survey results, I think a lot of people are doing both. Mm-hmm. They're either reading and then listening because they want more, or they're listening and then reading because they want more in that direction.
I sort of meant, do you think the podcast is finding new readers for the paper? Is that is that an objective of the thing?
That's a goal. Yes.
It is.
Yes. We do hope that because this is free, I mean, to get into the jargon, it's top of funnel. You know, we want to be reaching new people, and we hope that as they become loyal listeners of The Daily, they also form a connection with The Times and with our journalists.
And is it financially successful, The Daily?
It's early, but yes. I mean, we had a launch sponsor. We've had that sponsorship has ended, but we've had advertisers come in. So yeah, we're doing all right.
Okay, good. And is the audience still growing or has it plateaued? I mean, you've been going now for half a year or so.
That's
almost.
Right, yeah. It's still growing. It's, I think, in the summer, well, we've taken a couple days off for the first time, so that...
Congratulations.
Thank you. It felt good. So there's, you know, little dips there.
Yeah.
But generally, no, with the news being what it is, it's not really plateauing.
Yeah. And do you have a backup host for Michael?
Well, Michael took his first vacation, and we had a backup host. It was Caitlin Dickerson, who came from NPR to The Times. She's a reporter on the national desk, and she did great. And people, we were a little nervous about what the response would be, not because we had any doubts about her, but because we just didn't know
how. Well, it's a change, right?
Yeah,
and they've
exactly.
just gotten used to Michael.
Yeah, and people were really supportive. You know, we got a lot of emails saying, you're doing great, Caitlin. So that, I think that was an important sort of growing and relaxing moment for all of us to realize, okay, this isn't something where you take away one piece and it all falls apart.
Right. Let me ask about advertising in the show. How did you decide what goes in there in terms of advertising? How much did you wrestle over the number of spots and where they go? And why did you decide on the format that you have in terms of the ads? I'm channeling Lex here to ask about this.
Well, we're being pretty fiercely protective of having only one ad spot, given that it's a 20-minute show. It seems like more than that is asking a lot of listeners. And we were lucky in having a launch sponsor that not only were they okay with that, but they actually kept their ad to only 15 seconds instead of 30. I think they had
the
right to
go to 30. Oh, they set a very interesting precedent, right?
Yeah.
There's scarcity there in terms of the ad space.
And we got emails from people saying, thank you to BMW for keeping the ad so short. I mean,
if you hadn't had a launch sponsor, what would you have done, do you think?
Not launched so quickly.
Well, yeah, besides that. I mean, in terms of the ads, though, would you have been more open to having two in the middle or one at the top? Or because having a launch sponsor means it would be redundant to have two
right.
BMW ads
yes.
in there, right?
Yes. I think we would have pushed to still keep it to one. It just, at 20 minutes, we don't want to clutter things up with too many ads. But it's tough. I mean, I think The New York Times, it has a very strong church-state divide, obviously, between the newsroom and the business side. And
there aren't awkward elevator conversations with ad salespeople about how you could fit another 15-second ad in there.
Did I tell you about that elevator conversation?
No, but please
do. That truly happened.
Really?
Yeah.
Please tell.
Someone in advertising in the elevator said, you know, I love The Daily. I was listening to it, but I barely even heard the ad spot. And I said, oh, that's great. And then when I got out of the elevator, I realized that was exactly the wrong thing to say.
You just crushed that poor ad salesperson.
I know. I followed up later to say that I truly respect advertising for making what we do possible. But I do think that in podcasts, when it's a host read ad, you can put more ads in there because the ad has personality. I mean, you read your ads.
That's our business. Yeah.
And we're just not comfortable with that for a newsroom journalist like Michael to read an ad. I mean, that's a conversation that we'll probably continue to have because advertising continues to ask about it. But for now, when it's a new voice coming in and it does sound more like an ad when it's like that, then it's harder to have several of them in there without feeling like they're clashing in some way with the content.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's an argument that people – it happened in print and it's going to happen in audio and television. I mean, it's universal. So you've got the daily going. Is there an afternoon show coming? Is there a weekend show coming? Are you going to just conquer all day parts? Is that the plan?
We're talking about all of those things, yes. The first target is the weekend. That feels...
Why?
Because we do see... This surprised us, but our highest numbers for downloads and streams are on our Friday episodes, and it's because people...
Boy, that does surprise me.
Yeah. Especially the New York Times overall... By far, our highest traffic is on Mondays, but for the daily, it's the opposite. And we think that part of that is that people have an appetite for it on the weekend, and so they're listening to the last episode that was published. And we did a survey recently and asked people if they wanted it on the weekend, and
they said yes.
Yes, yes. It was a resounding yes.
So how is a weekend show? Do you feel like it has to be radically different? I mean, news still happens.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be radically different. I think it gives us a little more freedom to do some of the stories that have a bit less urgency. So there are a lot of fascinating stories coming out of the magazine or out of our investigations team that when you're just dealing with a Monday through Friday, it might feel like, is this really what I needed to know
or
today?
Do I have time to explain all that? Really?
Yeah, exactly. And so we're thinking that the weekend will give us a chance to explore some of that stuff.
But could be longer, I assume, right?
It could be a little longer, or it could be just one story instead of two stories.
What about the role? I mean, there are so many parts to Times coverage. What about the role of the arts and culture and books and all those things? Is that in the way that the paper seems to be slanted towards that material on the weekends and always has been, does that enter into your thinking about a weekend show?
We are thinking about how best to serve that content. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that we're going to go in the direction of having that be the weekend. Mm-hmm. But it definitely seems like there's room to do more with arts.
You sort of have to narrow cast in podcasting a little bit, right? You can't have a show, an audience that's going to be getting hard news most of the week and then suddenly give them something that feels soft and not relevant to their news needs.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's the way we're thinking about it is what would someone who listens to The Daily Monday through Friday want on the weekend? And we're thinking about it more as the magazine equivalent, the Sunday magazine equivalent of the newspaper rather than the arts and leisure equivalent.
So will you be pressing publish in the afternoon and then on the weekend too, essentially? Your life will be taken up by a 6 a.m. deadline and a 4 p.m.
No,
deadline?
No, I'm hoping to teach more people how to press publish very soon.
Yeah, I think that seems like a life-saving maneuver if I ever
yes.
heard one. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other shows that you're responsible for. I'm curious about how you, having established this giant footprint with The Daily, how you integrate shows that are as different as Modern Love and Dear Sugar and Popcast and Still Processing into a coherent brand. And if you're worried at all about the fact that they're very different people and subjects, does that matter?
I'm not worried about it because that's sort of what's so great about the New York Times. So in that sense, we're creating an audio equivalent of the New York Times, which has a lot of breadth to its coverage, which has Sunday Styles and Arts and Leisure and the magazine. And so we're basically, you know, we think of The Daily as essentially our A section.
Right.
And
oh, that's interesting.
And then we can build out from there.
And so you're not trying, there's not a house sound to New York Times podcast, you'd say.
It's a good question. I think there are common threads, and I would hope that as we build more shows, there does feel like a commonality to...
Do you have any vague ideas? I mean, I can see on your face, this is something everybody wrestles with, right? Do you have any sort of, if I could do it this way, I would? Like, what would those common sounds or thoughts or feeling, forms be?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is authority. Mm-hmm. That with still processing, obviously, Wesley Morris and Jenna Wortham, who host that show, are talking about generally very different things than Michael is, and they've got a very different style, but they are still experts in what they're talking about.
Oh,
and I think that listeners, I hope, get the same thing listening out of Still Processing, feel like, wow, these people know a lot and have really insightful things to say about this movie, this TV show, this album, in the same way that they listen to, Maggie Haberman and mm-hmm. Matt Apuzzo and feel that way about politics.
That's really interesting. If you have the filter of authority, it can help you sort for what you're looking for immediately, right?
Right.
I mean, it's very useful. What about the acquisition of Dear Sugar? That's really what it is, right? It was an existing show.
It was an existing show, yeah. And it was launched at WBUR by Lisa Tobin. And so we're now doing it in collaboration with WBUR, but the production is happening at The Times now.
Oh, it is?
Yes. And we're rebranding it slightly. It's now Dear Sugars, plural.
Oh, why?
It had been called Dear Sugar Radio. And so partly we thought, let's shed the radio.
Seems like a good decision.
Yeah. And then... Steve and Cheryl, the hosts of that show, Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond, felt pretty strongly that because they've come forward as two individuals behind the sugar identity, that it made more sense to acknowledge both of them in the name, which I think there's validity to that.
Those must have been interesting meetings.
Yeah. Well, because when the column started, the Dear Sugar column on the Rumpus, it was just one identity. And then, it was at that time Steve, and then Cheryl took it over. And so now it's the two of them embodying the sugars. And that is how letter writers for that show, which is an advice show, people write in mm-hmm. and their letters always start Dear Sugars. And Steve and Cheryl refer to themselves as the sugars. So we thought, let's lean into it.
Yeah, exactly. If that's
sugars.
What the audience is saying,
exactly.
Then you can understand that and work with that.
Yeah.
That's great. And is that also was this a unique case that you're going to be borrowing a show, taking on a show from WBUR because Lisa worked there? Or are you actually actively looking for shows you could add and create a kind of network?
I think both. I think this one was a little unique, but I think there might be other unique opportunities.
I'll start writing your pitch letters to the New York Times, ladies and gentlemen.
No, I mean, right for now, it's not a top priority. Mm-hmm. Our main priority right now is getting The Daily to a more sustainable place in terms of staffing, and then building it out, as we talked about, doing more with The Daily, But I do think that as opportunities come up, if there are things that we wouldn't be able to do otherwise or that really make sense to work with a partner, that's something we're open to.
Will you sit with me while I badly read an ad?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, thanks. We'll be right back. This episode of The Wolf Den is sponsored by the book Podcast Advertising Works: How to Turn Engaged Audiences into Loyal Customers. It's written by Glenn Rubenstein from the podcast ad agency Adopter Media. Glenn has worked in podcast advertising for over 5 years now. He's taken that experience and he's written a guide for both podcasters and podcast advertisers alike. The book explains everything from how podcast advertising rates are calculated to breaking down what makes for an effective podcast ad. I'd be interested to hear his comments about this read. It also gives a history of the medium and it talks about its evolution to where we are today. I'd love to know where we are today. I should probably read this book. And my colleague Lex Friedman is thanked in the dedication. It has great reviews, and the ebook version is on sale for 99 cents. You can buy it on Amazon and iTunes. That's Podcast Advertising Works, How to Turn Engaged Audiences into Loyal Customers by Glenn Rubenstein from Adopter Media. Well, you know Issa Rae from her hit HBO series Insecure. Now, the first season of her acclaimed podcast, Fruit, is available for free. This is the gripping audio drama that tells the story of X. He's an African-American pro football player. He's on a journey of self-discovery and sexual exploration. It's a series written and directed by Issa Rae. The Sarah Awards says Fruit, quote, raises the bar on what is possible in audio fiction. So you can listen to all of Fruit Season 1 right now on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. You can hear more of the story with Season 2 on Stitcher Premium. Just go to stitcherpremium.com/fruit. Well, I'm back with Sam, and we're talking about the New York Times and podcasting and her role in creating the juggernaut that is New York Times podcasting. You announced something called the Podcast Pitch Fest. What's the Podcast Pitch Fest? And I mean, I will speak as a producer. Pitches are something you live with but don't necessarily welcome because 95% of them don't turn out to be something you really want to do.
Yeah.
Right? So why are you doing this?
So we did it in October, and it was because it was happening anyway. You know, people, a lot of people had ideas, and they were coming at us in a kind of haphazard way with the ideas. And so we thought it would be valuable to have
people within the company.
Within the company, right. Yeah. But from all over the company, not just within the newsroom. So, you know, developers, designers, everyone. It feels like everyone is listening to podcasts and excited about podcasts,
except which is
great.
Except this podcast, sadly. But we're trying.
But so we wanted to put a little more rigor around it and just be clear about these are the kinds of things that we want you to think about when you're pitching. You know, think about who is the audience for this. Think mm-hmm. about why would the New York Times do this as opposed to someone else. And so Pitch Fest was a way for us to make it a little more structured and to also let people feel like they had an opportunity to be heard. So as part of that, we did workshops, open workshops where people could come talk about their idea.
Oh, before they submitted them.
Before they submitted them, yeah.
So how many Times employees are there?
The newsroom is about 1,200. So I don't actually
probably
know.
Probably total several thousand,
yeah,
at least,
yeah.
Right? How many pitches did you get?
We got about, I think about 90 pitches.
Oh, that's not too bad. You must have had a good filtering process,
well,
really.
You had to put some work into it.
Yeah.
And that was part of the idea. I think because of then the timing of the election and launching the Daily, I regret that we didn't have more time to spend with bringing some of those ideas to life. We still
right.
have them.
We still have them.
Yeah. And it was a good exercise, and I think we'll do it again and hopefully next time have a little more bandwidth to work with people.
Do you remember one of the more offbeat ideas from the Pitch Fest?
Well, one that came up from several people and continues to come up periodically is what can we do for kids? I mean, I think that's something that a lot of people have talked about, that it feels like there's this real opportunity to do podcasts that either are explicitly for kids or are for the whole family.
Right.
So we got a few different pitches about that.
What do you think about kids podcasting? I mean, is it something that because I'm a little bit of a skeptic. I know there are kids podcasts out there, but they're very hard to do when you think about how hard it is to access the podcast app for most people, and that kids seem to be more visually driven than driven by audio these days.
Yeah, although I've heard that people with kids and with an Alexa device or another, you mm-hmm. know, Google Home or one of those, feel like that's a real opportunity, that the kids know how to say, hey, Alexa, do this.
Oh, I agree with you.
That there in the living room, you could just have something playing.
So you have to have a name of a kid's podcast that Alexa will actually understand very clearly
yes.
the first time.
Yes.
That's the first thing you have to
and
do.
And then also cars. I mean, I think yeah. when you think about family car trips, and we certainly used to listen to the radio together.
You were forced to listen to NPR, I have a feeling.
Yes, NPR was on. I was also once forced to listen to this book on tape, Einstein's Dreams, and it
oh
was
my God.
So deadly.
How many hours was that?
I don't think we let it go on for too long. But I've never gotten into books on tape. My mom does them all the time.
Yeah, I think it is a little bit of a generational thing, maybe, or it really determined by the kind of commute that you have.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, so kids podcasting, do you remember any of the ideas? I'm just curious what you thought.
There was one which I think is a really good idea, which was a show about how to talk to your kids about difficult questions. And I like that idea a lot. I would like that show to exist. I think it's a bit of a tough sell. Why should the New York Times be the ones to create that show? Like, mm-hmm. what is our expertise there? And that's true with the kids stuff in general. Like, we don't even have comics. You know, we did a big special.
I've always really been sad about that.
That there are no comics?
Yeah. What's going on, really?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's something that the Times, in a broader sense, is thinking about. We had this big special print section for kids a couple weeks ago in the weekend section. And yeah, it's not something like right now. I have a 2-year-old and she goes and picks up the paper every morning on the stoop and she brings it in and doles it out. And
wow.
Yeah.
Got her trained.
No, it's nice. She tells us to share it. But it's nice that she's only 2 because we don't have to explain
right.
anything to her. But once she gets a little older, I'm not actually sure which section we're going to give her. Probably we'll keep giving her the arts, which is what we normally give her.
Yeah. There are just a lot of nice pictures
exactly,
there.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there are people dancing and things. It's pretty,
right.
it's pretty safe. Is there anything about the Times culture itself, the sort of institutional culture that you think made podcasting a difficult thing to adopt? And I'm thinking back to when I first became aware that the Times was doing podcasts. I was at WNYC. We went up and talked to people at the Times about their podcasts a decade ago or so, mm-hmm. and they never really seemed to get off the ground in a kind of fully fledged way. And I wonder what changed, or what did you do to try to produce the change that we've seen?
Yeah, I think the change is really the staffing. That the first time that the Times did audio, they did what I think has often happened at the Times with new initiatives, which is they grab a couple people who have been around and they say, hey, try this new thing. And this time what we did was we very strategically staffed up with audio professionals. So the people who – I'm the lone exception here. I mean, I've been at the Times for almost 6 years. But the rest of the team are people who came from public radio, from Gimlet, from, you know,
NPR.
who have been doing this for their whole careers. And so that has made a huge difference in the quality of the shows that we're putting out. And we're also, we're saying no to a lot of things. So, you know, even though we did have Pitch Fest and we do want to be welcoming for ideas, we are being very focused in what we actually launch. And the first time that the Times did podcasts, they launched 14, I think, pretty quickly. And so it was more like, okay, let's just try it all. Let's get stuff up and running.
The spaghetti against the wall theory of
exactly,
podcasting.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And we're trying to be a lot more deliberate and fully staff the things that we're doing and make them really high production value, but not do as many.
Are you given any kind of instructions about how many shows a year you need to launch?
No. And in that way, we are a bit like a startup in a lot of ways, and that's one of them, that we've pivoted on that a few times.
Yeah. So have we. I think that's an opportunity comes and you do it, and then there's a dry spell, and then you have an idea and you do that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, our latest pivot was to do even less than we had been thinking. So you know, we do.
Was that difficult?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about how that happened. How did you decide to do less, and who were the people objecting?
There was no one objecting. I mean, we decided because we were looking at what was ahead. We were looking at the shows we were planning to launch and specifically the hires that we needed to make. And it started to feel insane.
Like, I know that feeling very well.
It was like this, there just isn't the bandwidth at the top, you know, just the people who need to be making the hires and
signing off.
Yeah.
Finding them a desk.
Right. Exactly. And meanwhile, we have the daily churning every day and in need of constant feeding and care. And that's doing great, and we all know that there's something really special there. So why would we work to spin up a bunch more new things instead of saying, okay, we've created something that can be that is already big, but that can be a lot bigger. Let's turn to that. Let's make that as good as it can be. Let's build on that, and let's slow it down with everything else.
That's great. And the ad revenue conversations, you don't have those. No one is saying to you, or are you involved in, well, we need to get, you know, $50 million out of podcasting by 2025?
Yeah, I'm involved with the revenue conversations and, you know, managing our P&L. Mm-hmm. And it actually, one of the very satisfying things about this decision to narrow our focus was that it made sense from a programming perspective. It made sense from like a sanity perspective. And it also, it turns out, made sense from a business perspective.
Oh,
because a lot of the other things, yeah, I mean, the things that we were deciding not to do, each one of those things was a risk. And if one of them had been a huge hit and we had succeeded in selling it in a strategic way where we capitalized on the fact that it was a huge hit, then okay, that would have been great for the business. But in general, The Daily is a thing that is known. I mean, what we've found, especially with the New York Times sales team that's new to selling podcasts, they have a much easier time when they're selling a thing that exists
of
that
course.
They can point to. And
yeah.
So they were actually happy when we told them we're doing fewer things. They were like, this makes our lives easier. It's hard for us. You know, when we were constantly throwing, okay, here's still processing. Here's the run-up. Go sell them.
Yeah.
It was
it's
hard
confusing.
For them to get all of the details and know what they're out there selling. So it was an aligned decision.
That's great. Can I ask you about your competition? Up First. Oh, that
yes.
was a sinister laugh.
Yeah.
Tell me what you think about Up First. I feel like the name itself is a sort of assault on, you know, it's a little bit of a verbal, hey, we're here first.
Well, a fun fact about the name is that until days before the launch of The Daily, we were planning to call it First Up.
Oh, that would have been so beautiful. We'd had a First Up
and
an
Up First.
Then
yeah.
podcasting would be complete as far as I'm concerned.
But so when we saw that it launched and that was the day, we were like, no way.
Yeah.
I actually think... I think they are doing different things. I mean, when we talked earlier about what is the mission of The Daily and that we're not trying to be exhaustive, we're not trying to say, here's everything you need to know to start your day, I think that is more the approach that Up First is taking. And mm-hmm. so we're hearing from listeners who listen to both, who get something different out of both, and I think that's great.
Yeah, it's a successful show. I don't mean to impugn its success.
Yes.
It is very different.
It's very different. And I think... they've made different choices, and we feel good about the choices we've made, mm-hmm. and I think it's good for the ecosystem to have both of them out there. I also...
Aren't you glad you don't have to serve a radio audience at the same time, though?
So glad, yeah.
Yeah. It's really, really different, and you can hear it,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And I think it was an interesting choice on their part to use the established radio personalities instead of maybe... new voices.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to hopefully have that conversation later this year with someone from that show, because I would really like to learn how it was put together and what they had to do in order to make it even possible, because you can't ignore this vast radio audience that's driving the entire machinery of public radio, really, Morning Edition. It's a tough thing to say, oh, I'm going to take resources away from the number one thing we do and try an experiment.
Yeah, and I mean, that was a big part of why we thought there was an opportunity for us to enter the space, was that we knew that that there were various there was institutional baggage that public radio had that was keeping them from being able to do it. And we felt like, of all the people who could do it, if they're not going to do it, we can do it.
That's right.
And now they're doing it too.
And they'll probably have an afternoon show too.
Probably.
Yeah, and a weekend show, but that's okay. The audience is still growing for all of it,
yes.
So I think that's fine.
Yeah.
I want to turn to a slightly more personal set of things about you so people can get to know you a little bit better. But do you find yourself, are you surprised you're working in audio? I mean, you're a writer, right? That's sort of what your identity was before.
Yeah. Oh, I was an editor more than a writer, I think. But Yeah, it's a little surprising. I mean, I actually did some audio when I was at Slate. So Andy Bowers trained me.
That's great.
And I did some production there. But I certainly never thought that I would be coming back to it in this way. I think it's...
What did your experience at Slate teach you about your relationship to this medium? What did you learn there that has stuck with you?
That's a good question. I mean, I certainly got to witness firsthand the importance of charismatic hosts with good chemistry.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what the Gabfests are built on.
Absolutely.
And I remember I mostly produced this. We had a daily explainer podcast that I did on my own in the mornings. And then we had, I worked for a while for Double X, which was the women's site, and that had a Gabfest. And then I filled in a couple times producing the Culture Gabfest. And with that one in particular, because I didn't know them as well, sitting there and listening to them, I was like, I can't believe that they're just this witty and smart just off the cuff. And so that was, you know, I think when you listen to it, you sometimes assume that things were edited down in a certain way to make people sound smarter, and then being there for the taping and seeing how smart they sound just in the raw version was pretty amazing.
But you must have also learned something about how you can't just put three smart people in a room and expect a show to happen, right? Was there some shaping that you felt you learned how to do?
I honestly, like, I don't think I was doing enough of it to get that. Because I was mostly, I mean, it was like a side part of my job. I was mostly working as an editor on the site. But yes, I guess when you put it in my mouth, then sure, I learned that too.
Okay, good. Yes, then we can credit Andy Bowers for that. That's fine. The last thing I want to talk to you about is something that probably at least this audience has no idea that you've done, and that is you wrote a book with your mom.
I did.
Called 20-something.
Yes.
What was that about? And were you a 20-something when you wrote it?
I was a 20-something at the time. I was the resident 20-something. My mom had, she's a writer, a journalist, and she had written a cover story for the New York Times Magazine about 20-somethings and about this.
Was this about millennial 20-somethings? Was pre-millennials as a group or?
It was about millennials. And it was about, the article was focused on this one expert scholar. I think he was a psychologist, but let's call him a scholar who had this idea of, in some ways, standing up for millennials. Like a lot of people say, "Oh, millennials coming home,
terrible
living with their
people.
Parents, living on the couch.
Yeah.
Like, why can't they figure out what they want to do with their lives?" And actually, there's this school of thought that that's a distinct psychological phase. That just like toddlers go through this phase and adolescents go through this phase and are difficult, that there's this phase that young adults go through, and all of these things that we're seeing with millennials, those are things that they need to work out. And
right.
That's an important part of becoming an adult. And so don't give them such a hard time about it. And that actually, when you look at the numbers, you know, people have always been moving back home to live with their parents.
Home. I hated it, but I did it, right?
Yeah.
And I think my mom hated it too. Like, it's just something the circumstances required.
Right, right. And even more so when the economy is collapsing and
exactly.
when student loans are what they are. So the book was an expansion on some of the ideas that came out in the article. And when my mom was approached about it, she said, "Well, I only want to do this if I can do it with a real 20-something, specifically my daughter." And so I said, okay.
And what was it? How did it go? Writing a book with your mom? Is that like having her teach you to drive in some way since she was a working journalist?
Yeah, she didn't. My dad taught me how to drive. I wouldn't dare let my mom teach me how to drive. She would hold on to that thing that I think is meant for like your suit, hanging up your suit on the side and go...
Uh-huh.
Like when I was doing everything right. There was nothing to be nervous about. But yeah, writing the book actually went really well. I was waiting for the blow up. We had like this shared Dropbox folder, and in some ways it was stressful because I would wake up on a Saturday morning and just see all of these alerts of all these things that she was updating in the Dropbox folder. And I was like,
that's very stressful.
I guess I got to get to work too. And you know, I had a Monday through Friday full-time job.
Right.
So it really was a nights and weekend thing for me. But it was actually a really nice experience. It was her, I think, ninth or tenth book.
Oh, wow. So she really had a process.
She knew what she was doing. Yeah. And so I got to, I never would have chosen to write a book. I don't feel like I have the attention span for it. But with a co-author who knows what she's doing and who is really carrying the thing, I got to learn a lot about the process, and it was actually really fun.
So my last question really is, let's talk about millennials a little bit. You manage them. Do you have any? You are one, I think, or you're close to one.
I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence.
Yeah. Do you have any feelings you want to share with me about them?
They're interesting. Uh-huh. Yeah. Any on the record feelings? I certainly have off the record feelings.
Oh, I mean, this is, you could barely call this a record, really. Let's be honest.
No, I mean, it has been funny to. Because
I'm asking you because you're an authority and you wrote a book.
Yes, of course, of course. I mean, Lisa and I are both millennials and we're co-managing this team. And we keep being struck by the fact that there are some sort of cliches of millennials that we see in others that we just, we didn't come up that way. Uh-huh. And so it's funny.
Like which ones?
I think the biggest thing is like we both, I mean, I came up through magazines and she came up through public radio and it was the kind of thing where you do whatever job you need to do and you just bust ass and mm-hmm. do your best to impress everybody and, you know, work the hours you need to work. And if it's not clear where it's going for your career, you just roll with it because that's
right. It's a job.
It's a job, yeah. And I think that some of the people we're talking to now, I mean, in audio in particular, it's boom times.
It is.
And so I've been struck by the number of people who, where I would expect them to say, oh my God, the New York Times, what a dream. And I'm 24 and I can't believe that this is an opportunity I could have. What we're sometimes hearing is like, I want to focus on my, you know, my own stories. And it's like, really? You don't want to work alongside New York Times journalists? Like,
right.
you don't think that would be a good growth opportunity for you? So that's been a little surprising.
Yeah, I won't comment on that.
Hey, that's not fair. You made me comment.
My eyes are agreeing with you right now. They just can't see that. Thanks. Before I let you go, where can listeners follow you online?
Oh, on Twitter, I'm Scoots, which is Scoots. It's short for Scooter, which is my made-up nickname.
Oh, you mean you made up your own nickname?
I did, yeah.
Well, that's kind of sad when you think about it.
So, but it's been long enough now that it feels like a real nickname.
Of course. I will call you Scooter from now on whenever
do.
I see you. So it's Scoots.
Scoots.
Okay, very good. I want to thank you, Sam, for joining us today on The Wolf Den.
Thank you.
All right. I want to thank Harry Nelson and Jared O'Connell for their work on today's show. You can subscribe to The Wolf Den at earwolf.com, on Stitcher, on Apple Podcasts, anywhere you catch and listen to podcasts. Please rate the show on iTunes if you get the chance. It makes Lex very happy when people write nice things about him.
This is Matt Besser from Improv for Humans. It's an improvised podcast where we do a special thing every once in a while we call the narrative experiment, where we actually choose characters for our improvisers. They keep the character throughout the episode, and we basically do a sitcom. Check it out. It's called Mopes. It stars John Gapers, Jess McKinney, Eugene Cordero, three of my favorite improvisers. Check it out, humans. Mopes on Improv for Humans.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Risa Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act One of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.